Like to welcome everyone to class today. If you would get out your Bibles and open up to John chapter 18. John chapter 18. So, I told you last week that last week's study was the last study for the season or for the term, if you will, on the preservation issues related to preservation and the Bible issues and stuff like that. I said we would still have class throughout the summer, and we will. Hopefully, I will not be the only one teaching. There will be some other brethren here in the assembly that will be able to deliver some of the lessons. But let me just be frank about that. If I do teach, a lot of what I teach is probably going to be fairly off the cuff. Today's isn't, because what I'm going to plan on doing today is going through a study that I gave in last summer at the July conference in Chicago, titled "Is Absolute Truth Absolutely Necessary?" Okay. Now, I only had like 45-50 minutes to do this in Chicago, but I don't have the same time constraint. So if I want to make this last for two times, I certainly can do that. Okay. So anyway, just so you're aware of that, you know, how many of you guys are going to be in town next week? How many of you? So do you want to have class next Sunday?
Yeah.
I mean, we can do that. I can make this take long enough that we can get 2 weeks out of this. Okay. Well, then we'll just do that. So this has been on my mind for this particular topic has been on my mind. It was assigned to me last summer, so I have some stuff on it, but it's been on my mind since April. In April, somebody sent me an article about a situation that was happening on a college campus where, on this particular college campus, it was being argued and asserted that the idea of objective truth, the idea that truth is absolute or somehow objective and able to be known, was in fact a racist concept. Okay? Now, I'm not going to get into the whole thing about, I don't want to get into a whole thing about racism. That's not what this is about. It's about truth. I'm just using that to kind of introduce what we're talking about. But the idea that truth is, the idea that absolute objective truth, it is, in our culture right now, we are crossing over from just simply saying that that doesn't exist to now saying that concept is a racist concept or something along those lines. And so what I want to do is just kind of talk a little bit about the idea of absolute truth and why absolute truth is absolutely necessary. So to get started, I want you to look at John 18. John chapter 18. Some of you may already know where I'm going with this, but, or at least to get started. So, Jesus is ultimately brought before Pilate, right? Before Jesus is crucified and so forth, he's brought before Pilate, and Pilate interrogates him and stuff like that. And you guys know the story. We've studied it. We went through the book of Mark that, you know, eventually that Pilate can't find any fault with Jesus and so forth, and is willing to, you know, let him go. And you guys are familiar with those aspects of it. Look at verse 37. John 18, verse 37. Pilate therefore said unto him, "Art thou a king then?" Jesus answered, "Thou sayest that I am a king. To this end was I born, and for this cause came I into the world, that I should bear witness unto what? The truth. Every one that is of the truth heareth my voice." Now, there's a lot of things we could talk about just there in verse 37. Number one, is Jesus ultimately going to die for his claim to be God? Okay? So, we could get into that whole thing. That's not what I want to get into. But notice what it says there at the second half of that verse. He says, came I into the world that I should bear witness unto the truth. Okay? Everyone that is of the truth heareth my voice. Now look at Pilate's reaction, verse 38. He says, Pilate saith unto him, "What is truth?" Okay? Now, when Pilate asks that, Pilate is asking like one of the fundamental central questions that have ever been asked in world history. Okay, from the point of view of philosophy and so forth. And I don't know, when I read that question, I almost can hear the sarcasm seizing, coming out of Pilate's mouth when Jesus gets done saying, "Hey, I came to bear witness to the truth, and everyone that is of the truth heareth my voice." And his reaction to that in verse 38, Pilate saith unto him, "What is truth?" It's almost, you can almost hear Pilate saying it in a way where he's doubting that that even what? Exists. Okay? So, Pilate's question here is one of the questions that throughout history, philosophers and so forth have been endeavoring to try to ask and answer. In 2006, I'm sure most of you know who Josh McDowell is, or have heard of him, okay? In 2006, Josh McDowell wrote a book called The Last Christian Generation. And he had some statistics in that book that I thought were interesting. So he reported in that book from 2006. So this data is now, 11 years old, or 10 years old at least. So I looked for some more current data just very quickly and couldn't really find anything that I thought was directly pertinent. So I'm just going to share this with you. He reported in 2006 that 81% of teenagers say they believe that all truth is relative to the individual and his or her circumstances. Okay? So put that into layman's terms. What would that mean, or what would that look like practically? So the average young person, if you want to call them a millennial, I don't know, let's just say young person. The average young person has what view of truth? Who decides what's true?
They
do. Okay? They are the ultimate arbiter of what is true and what is not true. Okay? Now, those figures were just for teenagers in general. Okay? When he asks young people that consider themselves to be quote unquote Christian teenagers, 70% of Christian young people said that they believe there is no absolute moral truth. That was 70% of churched, so-called Christian young people. Obviously, this doesn't necessarily mean all these people are saved, but they're church-going young people, and 70% of them said that they don't believe there's any such thing as an absolute moral truth. Okay, so McDonald's commentary on the situation to me is it's instructive, and working where I work for my secular job, I can tell you that it's accurate. Okay. That the common understanding that is out there among young people is that there's no such thing as absolute truth, that truth doesn't exist, that truth is relative or individually determined or any of those sorts of concepts. They might even Christian young people will have adopted this view, okay, that something is not true until they choose to believe it. Okay, so it's only true if they what? If they believe it. If they don't believe it, then it's not what? Then it's not true. Okay, so in other words, on that view, Christianity, the truth of the gospel, is not objectively true. It is only true because they choose to what? Choose to believe that it's true. Okay, so there's all these views and all these things that are out there about this. Okay, and then the concept, it follows from that the following then. Well, if me believing it makes it true, if I at some point choose not to believe it, now it's not what? Now it's not true anymore. Okay? So that this concept is out there. Now I'm just curious, I know most of you don't necessarily work directly with people this age, but I'm sure you've observed this or heard this potentially amongst people that are out there that you might come into contact with. But what I'm saying is, this way of thinking is a real way of thinking that is out there, okay? And it is, it's not getting better, it's getting worse as far as how people view this concept, okay? And it just highlights the idea to me that, Americans in particular seem to be pretty fickle. Let me tell you what I mean by that. On the one hand, we demand the truth from our spouse, our doctor, our banker, our 401k manager, our accountant, okay, the pharmacist about what's in the pills, okay. all these aspects of our life, from our politicians, from all people in all walks of life, we demand to be told the truth in the news and blah, blah, blah. Thus you have all the debates now about fake news and what really is news and all that sort of business. But my point is, we demand the truth in all these areas of life. But then when it comes to the issues, then when it comes to the issue of what one chooses to believe about morality, and I'm just going to use this word even though I don't like it, or religion, now all of a sudden everything is what? Now everything is subjective and relative. Okay? So they want the truth and they want nothing but the truth when it comes to these certain areas. But then when it comes to issues related to religion or morality, now all of a sudden there is no moral, there is no absolute truth when it comes to those sorts of concepts. Now, to me, as I've thought about that, to me the only reason, the only explanation for that is, if the truth exists in those two areas, then that means that they might actually be held accountable for what they think or what they believe in those two arenas of their life. Okay? And that's what folks don't want. They want to try to escape accountability. Okay? So you ever deal with somebody and they ask you this question, something along the following lines. They'll say, well, what do you do with the guy in the middle of the jungle that's never heard of the gospel? Okay? We could get into that in a different time. But you know what that, fundamentally, that's not the point. The point is, we're not talking about that guy right now. We're talking about you. And you have heard. So what are you going to do? How are you going to respond? So people, they come up with all these ways to try to escape accountability and escape all of this. And one of them is by just saying that there is no such thing as truth. Okay? And Pilate, way back in the first century, he asks what is essentially the fundamental question that in modern 21st century America we are still dealing with, and that is the question of what is truth. So what I want to do is, I've got basically three or four points here. The first one is, I want to spend a little bit of time talking about inadequate views of truth. Then I want to talk about the correspondence view of truth. Then I want to discuss thy word is truth. And then offer some final thoughts or practical things to maybe think about when it comes to this discussion. Okay? So does everybody kind of understand the topic and what we're doing here? Does anybody have any questions about that or comments? Okay. If not, then let's go first to the first point, which is inadequate views of truth. Okay? So I've got these written up here. There are more than three. Okay, I'll just say that. There are more than three, but we're just going to talk about the three most popular. The three that you are probably maybe most likely to encounter when you deal with somebody. Okay? And those three are, number one, relativism. This is the idea that truth is independently determined. The second one is pragmatism. This is the idea that truth is what works or what accomplishes the result that I want to accomplish. And then the third one is subjectivism, and this is the idea that truth is what feels good. Okay? So we're going to kind of talk about those three. So to get started, why don't you go over and grab Proverbs chapter 3 just quick. Go grab Proverbs chapter 3. All right, as you get Proverbs chapter 3, this simply stated, relativism is the first one we're going to talk about, is the idea that there is no absolute truth. Okay? Now, some of you guys have heard me mention this in the past, so you might already know the answer, but what's a fundamental basic problem with that?
Well, you can't say not as absolute because they are stating an absolute, right?
Right. So it's a self-defeating statement, right? So in other words, if I say there's no such thing as absolute truth,
that's an absolute.
Am I claiming to absolutely know for sure that there's no such thing as absolute truth? Okay. Now, this is so basic. This is so easy. When you catch somebody talking like this, or saying this, all you have to do is flip the statement on them to demonstrate to them that that's not going to what? That's not going to work. Okay? You just have to pay attention to like what people are saying and realize, oh, wait a minute, that what they're saying, we're not, what they're saying as a philosophical statement or as a statement of logic doesn't work. Okay? Saying there's no such thing as absolute truth would be the same thing as saying the following. Okay? You ready? This sentence is not in English. What's wrong with that statement? It's false. It's in English, right? So when somebody comes along and they say something like this, they are making a statement that does not hold any water at all on the basis of what they're trying to say. So let's look at a couple scriptures about this, and then I'll say a few other things about this. Look at Proverbs 3. Look at verse 7. He says, Proverbs 3, 7, Be not wise in thine own eyes. Fear the Lord and depart from what? See, this idea is basically that who's deciding what's true? The individual what? Person is. Okay? So there are verses like this all through the Scripture warning people about this kind of thinking. Come over to Proverbs 12. Look at verse 15. Proverbs 12, look at verse 15. It says, "The way of a fool is right in his own eyes, but he that hearketh unto counsel is what? Is wise." Okay, so that was, did everybody have the right verse? That was Proverbs 12, verse 15. Let me just read that again, at least the first part. The way of a fool is right in his own what? So that, are there a lot of people that are just trying to justify what they're doing based upon their own understanding, their own way of thinking, their own justification? Okay? Now, I'm not, what did God the Holy Spirit say about that thinking and the person that's going to think that way? They're foolish. Okay? It's not going to work. It's not going to be able to sustain itself. Come over to Proverbs 16, look at verse 2. Proverbs 16, verse 2, all the ways of a man are clean in his own eyes. Of course they are. Paul gets into that in Romans, right? He talks about the meanwhile they're else accusing or else what? Excusing one another, right? Well, that guy, when he does it, he's what? He's a bad dude. Well, when I do it, I'm justified when I what? When I do it. Okay? Chapter 21, Proverbs 21, look at verse 2. Proverbs 21, verse 2. It says, every way of a man is right in his own what? In his own eyes. But the Lord pondereth what? The hearts. Right? So the Lord, is the Lord able to discern what's really going on in the heart of that man?
Yes.
Okay? The answer to that is yes. Look at Proverbs 30, verse 12. Proverbs 30, verse 12. Proverbs chapter 30, verse 12. It says here, there is a generation that are pure in their own what? Eyes. And yet is still not washed from their filthiness. So they think they're what?
Pure.
They think, not only do they think they're okay, but they think they're what? They don't just think they're not dirty. They think they're pure. They think they're clean. They think they're okay. They think they're all right. Okay? So, this is the idea here that, again, truth is individually determined. People doing what is right in their own eyes. The idea that there is no such thing as absolute truth. And we've talked about how that's a self-defeating statement, how it's not going to work. Okay? It claims to be absolutely true while denying the absolute nature of truth. So statements like that are not going to work. Okay? And as I said before, the biggest challenge to absolute truth that our modern culture has to offer can be defeated simply by turning the tables on the argument. Okay? When you encounter somebody saying something like this, all you have to do is take you don't have to quote the Bible, you don't have to run to the verses, Not that I'm saying you shouldn't do that, but I'm saying you don't have to do that just to make a very simple fundamental point that that is not going to what? That that's not going to work. Okay? Now, that might require you to sort of pay attention to what people are saying, but hopefully you're doing that anyway, right? Hopefully you're sort of paying attention. Now, anyway, now let me just make a point here then about... So, what happens in a class that I teach is that everyone can understand this as a basic statement. But then when it comes to the issue of morals, they still want to say that that's what? That that's relative. Okay? There's something that you have to understand about the concept of the moral law. Okay, so in order to do that, come over with me. Just this isn't in the notes, but come over to Romans and get Romans 2. Romans chapter 2. There's a parenthesis here starting at verse 13. He says, Paul says, "For not the hearers of the law are just before God, but the doers of the law shall be justified. For when the Gentiles, which have not the law," okay, "do by nature the things contained in the law." Does everybody understand what he's saying? So, does the law say, don't lie, don't steal, don't murder, don't commit adultery, so on and so forth, right? Okay? The Gentiles, do they have that law? Did God give the Gentiles that law? So Paul's saying here in verse 14, "For when the Gentiles which have not the law do by what? Nature the things contained where?
In the law,
these having not the law are a law unto themselves." Now this is what C.S. Lewis called the moral argument for God's existence in mere Christianity. Okay? And then it says, verse 15, so these Gentiles in verse 14 that don't have the law, but are doing by nature the things contained in the law, okay? Verse 15 says that this shows, which show the work of the law written in their what? Hearts. Their conscience also bearing what? Witness. And their thoughts the meanwhile accusing or else what? Excusing one another. Okay? So, this is what C.S. Lewis calls the argument for moral law, and he's saying that, and what this argument is saying is that God wrote moral standards somehow on the heart of what? Man. That man somehow by nature knows certain things are not right and certain things are not wrong, and his conscience bears witness to this, and to get around his conscience, he is accusing or else what? Excusing, right? What you need to understand though about this moral law is that this moral law is prescriptive. The moral law identifies how men ought to behave. It is not necessarily descriptive of how they actually what?
Behave.
Does everybody understand the difference? Okay? God, the moral law says or prescribes how man should behave, but it does not necessarily mean that man behaves in accordance with what that law is, right? Or else he would not have a conscience to meanwhile accusing or else what? Excusing, right? So the moral law concept is prescriptive. It identifies how people ought to behave. It does not necessarily identify how they actually what?
Do behave.
So should people not lie? Should people not steal? Should people not murder and so on and so forth, right? They should not do those things. The moral law is prescribing that behavior, but it doesn't necessarily mean that that's how they actually what?
Live.
Okay, now just as a concept, right? So if I go to the doctor because I'm sick and he writes me a prescription, what's he saying?
Take this.
Hey, if you take this, you'll what? Hopefully you'll get better and feel better, right? So He's prescribed it to me. But that doesn't mean I have to go get it filled and actually what? And actually take it, right? So what God has done is He's prescribed moral standards to man. He's in a moral law that is absolute. The issue is whether or not man is what? Is going to do it, and whether or not man is going to follow it. So the idea, so when people start saying that, well, morality is relative, what they're looking at is, well, if morality was absolute, everybody would behave the same way. But that's missing the point, right? The moral law of how humans should behave has always been what? Prescriptive. It's never been describing necessarily how all humans actually what? Live and behave. So does God have an absolute standard of morality that He has established? Yes. Whether or not everybody follows it or not is a different question. But morality is, now think about that, okay? So somebody says the following. I gotta be careful in here because in my high school class, it's all a bunch of young people, so I kinda talk about their grandmas and grandpas and the things that the grandmas and grandpas say. But I got grandmas and grandpas in here now, so I'm gonna be careful and behave myself. Okay? Now, if somebody says, man, things are just going to hell in a handbasket and the world is getting worse. Grandpa says that. Grandma says that, right? I remember the good old days. Right? Well, as soon as somebody says that, what is that implying?
Things are worse.
Well, based compared to what? But you're missing my point. Compared to what? So as soon as I say, this is worse than this, am I implying that there's some standard to compare this and that to? Exactly. Okay? So if I'm talking about Hitler, for example, and I say Hitler was evil. Okay. How do I know Hitler was evil? Based on what standard is Hitler evil? Okay, so how do I know his actions are not appropriate? Because there has to exist somewhere. And even for me to make a statement and for that statement to have any meaning, it implies that there is a moral what? A moral standard by which we can judge somebody like who? By Hitler. And this is fundamentally, in a nutshell, C.S. Lewis's whole point about the moral argument for the existence of God. Okay? Now, so we took half an hour and got through that. So that was pretty good because I'm really stretching this now. Does anybody have any questions or comments about that first inadequate view of truth? Yeah, Norm?
Out of curiosity, is what Paul talks about there, does that mention anywhere in the Old Testament about standards of
the Gentiles? That's a good question. I'd have to get back to you on that.
I don't know
right off the top of my head. I'd have to kind of look into that a little bit more. Okay. So that's the first inadequate view. The second inadequate view that we're going to talk about is called pragmatism. Okay? Pragmatism is the idea that truth is what works. So if it works, if it brings about the intended result, then it has to be what?
True.
Okay? So many people believe that truth is found in utility or usefulness or, as I said, what works. So in other words, knowing is something, let me start over, excuse me. In other words, knowing is something we do and is best seen as a practical activity. Questions of meaning and truth are also best understood in this context. Now, one of the most famous pragmatists was a guy named William James, and he summed up his position when he wrote, "Truth is the expedient in the way of knowing." So in other words, if it works, if it's expedient, if it brings about the result that I want, then it's what?
True.
If it doesn't, then it's what? Not true. Let me show you some things from Scripture about this. Go to Daniel 5. Go over to Daniel 5. Daniel chapter 5, So in this particular passage, this is the handwriting on the wall chapter. Okay? So just to get you up to speed real quick, Belshazzar, the last king of Babylon, is having a party. And in this party, he brings in the vessels of silver and gold and all the implements from the temple that they had gathered when the captivity started. And they're having this party out of the implements from the temple there. And in the middle of the party, the finger of God comes and writes on the wall. Okay, you guys remember the story, hopefully. Okay, look at verse 5, in the same hour came forth fingers of a man's hand and wrote over against the candlestick upon the plaster of the wall of the king's palace. And the king saw a part of the hand that wrote. Then the king's countenance was changed and his thoughts troubled him, so that the joints of his loins were loosed and his knees smote one against another. The scripture is saying his knees are literally knocking together. He's so scared.
He's scared.
Okay. Verse 7, then the king cried aloud to bring forth the astrologers, the Chaldeans, and the soothsayers. And the king spake and said unto the wise men of Babylon, whosoever shall read the writing and show me the interpretation thereof shall be clothed in scarlet and have a chain of gold about his neck and shall be third ruler in the kingdom. So, what's his first answer to the problem? He calls in the wise men of Babylon, right? The magicians, the soothsayers, the Chaldeans. He calls in all these guys and he says, tell me what's going on here, and if you do, I'll make you great in the kingdom, is basically what he says, right? Okay? Of course, I'm paraphrasing a little bit. Verse 8, then came in all the king's wise men, but they could not read the writing, nor make known the interpretation thereof. Then was King Belshazzar greatly troubled, and his countenance was changed in him, and his lords were astonished. Now the queen, by reason of the words of the king and his lords, came into the banquet house, and the queen spake and said, O king, live forever. Let not thy thoughts trouble thee, nor let thy countenance be changed. There is a man in thine kingdom in whom is the spirit of the holy, notice, gods. And in the days of thy father, light and understanding and wisdom, like the wisdom of the gods, was found in him, whom the king, Nebuchadnezzar, thy father, the king, I say, thy father, made master of the magicians, astrologers, Chaldeans, and soothsayers. For as much as an excellent spirit and knowledge and understanding, interpreting dreams, and the showing of hard sentences and dissolving of doubts were found in the same Daniel, whom the king named, Belshazzar, now let Daniel be called, and he will show what? What's he after here? How's he after it? He only calls in Daniel when everything else doesn't what? When everything else doesn't work. Okay? Then we're okay, fine. My own dudes, they can't tell me what's going on here, so I guess I'll call in Daniel. Verse 16. I have heard of thee, this is Belshazzar talking to Daniel, I have heard of thee that thou canst make interpretation and dissolve doubts. Now if thou canst read the writing and make known to me the interpretation thereof, thou shalt be clothed with scarlet and have a chain of gold about thy neck and shalt be third ruler in the kingdom. So my point to you is this, when does Belshazzar bother to get Daniel? When nothing else what? Works, right? When everything else fails, that's when he decides he's going to go get Daniel, right? So the idea here is, Belshazzar is only interested in what Daniel has to say when everything else doesn't what? This is emblematic of a very pragmatic approach, right? Well, this didn't work, this didn't work, this didn't work, this didn't work, so I'm going to do what?
Something else.
So I'm going to do something else. Okay? Let's go to 2 Corinthians 4. Verse 17. Paul says, for our light affliction, which is but for a moment, worketh for us a far more exceeding eternal weight of glory. Now look what he says. While we look not at the things which are what? But at the things which are what? not seen? Is Paul asserting that there's truth that is not going to be known by pragmatic means? Okay. He says, while we look not at the things which are seen, but at the things which are not seen, for the things which are seen are what? Temporal, but the things which are not seen are what? Eternal. So Paul instructs believers not to look at their present circumstances to determine what is true, but to focus their attention on eternal unseen things. Right? So from the point of view of a believer, a Bible believer in particular, the idea that truth is going to be determined by what works is not necessarily going to be the good approach. Now let me just say a couple things about that before we move on. Pragmatists. Now why does a pragmatist want you to agree with them? Okay, so I kind of set you up a little bit, but that's fine. Pragmatists do not want us to accept a pragmatic view of truth because it seems to be effective. They want you to accept it because they believe it corresponds with the way things actually are. Does that make sense? So they're not saying, listen, Brian, what you need to do is you need to accept pragmatism because it works. They're saying you need to accept pragmatism because it is. Because it's the way things actually work. So that illustration's lost, so let me give you a different one. Okay? Lies. Do lies often work?
Yeah.
Do lies often accomplish the intended outcome?
Yeah.
Okay? Lies often work, but their effectiveness doesn't make them true. They are still what? Lies. Okay? They remain false regardless of the result. Okay? Is that true? Why is that true? Okay, because it corresponds with reality, right? 5 + 5 = 10 is true, not because it works, but because it's correct. Is everybody with that? Why is it correct? Because it corresponds with what? Okay, so if I have 5 slices of pizza, and I add 5 more slices of pizza, how many slices of pizza do I have? Whoa. Okay. If I have 5 tacos and I add 5 more tacos, how many tacos do I have? 10. Okay. If I have 5 bamboo shoots and I add 5 more bamboo shoots, how many bamboo shoots do I have? 10. Is that true in America, Mexico, and Asia? Yeah. Not because it works, but because it's what? Because it's correct. Is everybody with that? Okay, amen. That was a tough one. You guys
got to realize where grandpa and grandma are.
You said it, not me, so.
Yeah.
So a third view is called subjectivism. Okay, and as you can see on the board, subjectivism is the idea that truth is what feels good. Okay? Supporters of this view argue that truth is what provides a satisfying feeling, while error is what feels bad. Okay? So if it feels good, if I get enjoyment out of it, then it's what?
True.
It's okay. If it feels bad and I don't get enjoyment out of it, then it has to be what? Not true or false. Okay? Thus, truth is found in our subjective feelings according to this form of subjectivism. Okay, so if I say, now let me get a good example here. Okay. If I say, I love pizza. What am I saying?
Pizza.
I'm just saying, most of the time I'm just saying that I just really like pizza, right? Okay. If I say I love pizza, I'm probably not saying that I have warm romantic feelings toward pizza. But I also say I love my wife. So when I say I love pizza and I say I love my wife, am I saying the same thing about my wife than I'm saying about the pizza? Don't tell her we're doing this, okay? No, I'm not. Obviously not, right? Okay? But what subjectivism is saying is that however your personal private feelings are toward that thing, whatever it is, and if you feel favorably to it because it makes you feel good, then it has to be what? True. So, it's somewhat similar to this, but not exactly identical. Okay, because this one is based on more about what is feeling good. This is just a stupid statement. Okay, this is slightly different. It might end up sort of in the same place, but it's really the idea that truth is found in one's own subjective feelings towards something, right? So, in other words, if Tom likes to be poked in the eye with sticks, okay, then we should all what? Poke him in the eye with sticks, because he likes to be being poked in the eye with sticks is what?
True.
It's true. It's good. It makes me what? Makes me feel good to be poked in the eye with sticks. Whereas if he doesn't want to be, I'm assuming you don't, if he doesn't like being poked in the eye with sticks, and we all go and try poking him in the eye with sticks, now he doesn't like that because he doesn't like it, and so now it's not what?
True.
Okay, I know I'm sort of giving you, I'm trying to give you an illustration to help you understand what this view is saying. Okay? And how people that adopt this view think. So here's one reason why this isn't going to work. Okay? It's readily apparent that bad news, which makes us feel bad, is true. Right? So, if you're sitting in the doctor and the doctor comes in and goes, you've got this, whatever it is, you're not like, no, I don't. That doesn't make me feel good, so it's not true. I mean, you can do that if you want to, but is that a pretty dumb way of acting?
Yeah.
Okay. However, if what feels good is always true, then why don't my students feel good when they receive poor grades on their report card? You see the point? Okay. You've heard the old adage that the truth hurts. Right? You've all seen the movie A Few Good Men with Jack Nicholson. And what's the famous line from that movie? You want the truth, you can't handle what? The truth, right? So, furthermore, feelings are relative to individuals. Therefore, what feels good to one might not for another. Is truth how one is to account for these subjective differences? If so, then truth would be relative. But we've already identified that it what? That it can't be. Okay? You need to understand, this piggybacks on both of this. Is anyone warm in here right now?
Yes.
Mike's warm, okay? Now, is Mike here being warm subjective?
Yes.
You be careful how you answer it. So if Mr. Dibble in the back there saying, yeah, of course it's subjective because I'm not warm. On the surface that makes sense, right? But here's the problem. What time is it right now? Quarter two. Okay? So does Mr. Dibble in the back not feeling warm change the fact that what's today's date? The 21st. That May 21st, 2017, at 9:45 a.m., Mike Erspalmer felt warm.
Doesn't change it.
It's not It's not subjective. You feeling cool and him feeling warm is not like a subjective thing, right? He absolutely feels warm. You absolutely feel cold. You just have a disagreement about the temperature of what? The room. So this thing that seems on the surface to be this subjective thing, really in actual fact isn't. Let me give you another illustration. When two people disagree about abortion, one person says abortion is okay, and another person says abortion isn't, or it's wrong, okay? Are they just having a subjective feelings disagreement, or are they really disagreeing about something objective? They are. One thinks it's absolutely wrong, and the other one what? Is everybody with that? Oh, geez. Okay. Now, do you want to know why the abortion debate, one reason why the abortion debate never goes anywhere? It's because they're not arguing about the same thing. The pro-life position is what? Life begins at conception. To kill that baby is what?
Murder,
right? What's the pro-choice position? The pro-choice position is that it's a woman's right to choose what she does with her own what? With her own body. And so, now they go into the public arena and start arguing with each other when they're not even arguing about the same thing. So do they have an objective, factual disagreement about what the nature of the argument is? I'd say they do. The one says it's this, the other says it's what? It's that. So this subjective idea that truth is just what feels good, this isn't going to work either, okay? All three of these views make the assumption that they correspond with what? Well, truth. I have truth up there, which is fine, but I'm going to write this up here. Reality. Okay? Thereby, they assume or pre... So every single one of these is assuming that truth corresponds to what? Reality. While they are trying to say that absolute objective truth doesn't what? Exist. Okay? So, I don't know how I did all this in 40 minutes. Anyone have any comments about that? Yeah, Nate?
On this objectivism, this is the one that I think trips up a lot of Christians. That are you at peace with whatever decision? I believe that's where it stems from originally, is this idea that I can determine what is true for my life, what God has for my life, by
my feelings.
Whatever feeling I have about the situation or choice I make. Not necessarily grounded in what Scripture teaches. You know, and you've probably heard this, I've heard a lot of pastors say this before when they've counseled people, that they've said, I prayed about it and I have peace that I should divorce my wife or husband. Or some other bad choice. We know it's bad from Scripture, but it stems from that subjectivity.
I think what a lot of religious people do is they just use their religion to manipulate people to justify their own behavior. Okay? So, trying to keep names out of it, some of you can maybe end up figuring out what I'm talking about. But, I, early on in a certain relationship I had, I wanted to take the individual to a function, to an event. And so I was trying to be a respectful young man, and so I called the father and I said, there's this event, I would like to take your daughter to this event. And he says to me, well, I'm going to have to pray about that and get back to you. And so right away I'm like, oh, geez. I knew what was going to happen. Okay. So a week later I phoned back and I said, well, you know, this event is coming up and I need to know, you know, what you think. He's like, well, I was praying about it and God told me that you shouldn't do that. Okay. So, my reaction maybe was not the best, but I said it. And I said, well, that's funny because I prayed about it too and he told me it was okay. Now, let me just say, at that point, to your point, Nate, I had learned some things about thinking about the will of God. Because previous to this, I had broken up with a girl by telling her it wasn't God's will for us to go out anymore. Okay? Now, when I did that, did God tell me that? I just didn't want to go out with her anymore. So what did I do? I played the religious game. I brought God into it and said, well, you know, God told me that, you know, this isn't working out. Because now I'm making an argument that in religion she can't argue with. Because now if she says, well, I don't feel the same way, then I'm like, well, what do you do? Are you arguing with God? So I think Nate is correct. I think that a lot of the traditional truth about how believers should discern God's will in their life is based on this. And I think in some ways it's even a little more insidious than that, because some will try to look at the circumstances of their life and try to determine based on the circumstances whether or not God's happy with them or not. Okay? Norm?
Did you want to make reference in your next lesson to the series that you did on finding God's will?
From a few years back?
Yeah.
That was part of a bigger series on prayer, I thought. But
you could just give the lesson numbers, maybe.
Yeah, I could probably look those up. Yeah, but the subjectivism is the idea that, look, this is the idea that what you do in your life is you just read the tea leaves. Right? And you try to discern what God is doing or not doing based upon what? How you feel about it. The problem with that is, do you feel the same way about anything today that you did yesterday? I mean, yeah, there's some things you probably feel the same way, but are you feeling subject to change all the time, right? And that's why this as a view of truth isn't going to work, because you have nothing to anchor it back to what? Reality. Okay, Mike?
As far as relativism goes, how do I deal with those that when you say there is no absolute truth? I mean, he's try to deal with that issue of there is no absolute truth. But I run into Hegelians who say there's truth, then there's antithesis, and to another antithesis is an antithesis. So they would think that's silly, the statement there is no truth, because truth is constantly dynamic and flowing, and I think they would just
Well, a dialectic view of truth is a completely different model. And you're right. They would say that's stupid.
In the 60s, and I'm still confused why we have such a term as postmodernism and all that. Because in the 60s, I was running into all this stuff when I first went to college.
Postmodernism.
Suddenly in the 80s, they're talking about postmodernism. And I said, wait a minute, that's what was going on in the campuses of the 60s when I ran into. What are they talking about?
Postmodernism is just a new term for an old idea. This is what they do.
Well, in the literature, is it?
Well, in the literature, maybe not, but so when I was in college, we had a guy come in and give a talk, and he talked about the difference between modernism and postmodernism.
That's what I was, a modernist.
I don't have a lot of notes on this right now, so I'm sort of just working off some just recollections of some things. But the biggest difference between postmodernism and modernism is that this one they'll say, and this is getting into some pretty heavy philosophy, but this is the idea that there's a meta-narrative or a bigger overarching story, right? Postmodernism is the idea that there is no what? Meta-narratives. That things... Nate, can you elaborate on that at all or not?
For you, I would look at William Lane Craig talked about this specifically in one of his lectures. What modernism did is the driving force behind that was scientific stuff. Scientists are the new God. They tell you what is true, what is not true, and it's found out in a lab.
what postmodernism specifically was, and we're starting to see that a little bit more today than maybe 20 years ago when they were screaming postmodernism, is now that they're walking away even from the sciences. And you see this with the no gender thing and all that kind of stuff now. And they're saying that everything is my truth. I determine my truth for myself. Even the scientists can't tell me what's right or wrong anymore. And it's branching out more than just morality stuff. Modernism really attacked morality and religion, and saying those kind of things are subjective. You figure out real truth from sciences. Postmodernism now is throwing even the sciences under the bus.
I don't know. I hesitate to even bring this up, but I'm rolling around in my mind if I think the whole flat earth debate is a postmodern thing. Okay? Because in that whole debate, literally, if you're going to embrace that idea, you have to throw out every scientific, mathematical thing that you were ever taught, that we ever thought we knew, and say it was all wrong. Okay? So if you're gonna, so to me, that seems to me to be would fit here as a concept that is now saying, at least at a minimum, saying all that stuff is not right, at all, and it never was, and we were all lied to from a scientific point of view. Okay. So I don't remember how we got on all that, but it's interesting conversation. So, yeah, Mike, I think your question, now that I'm thinking about it, is what brought us there. This, when they were talking about that stuff in the 60s, they didn't really know what to call it yet. This is the way I see it. Maybe somebody would see it a little bit different. But they didn't really know what to call it that until they came up with this. And I can't spell, so don't hold that against me. Okay? So when I was in college in the 90s, this was like, I remember sitting at Baker Chapel at GBC, and a speaker coming in, a former graduate of the college coming in and giving a whole lecture on this. And thinking to myself at the time, huh? What? Like, not having a clue what the guy was even talking about. And I remember looking around at everyone else, and they're like, I mean, it was bad. It was really boring and it was really bad, and I don't think anybody really, you know, I had to actually go out and try to figure out what that was out for myself, okay? But that's where I first encountered that term. And then the whole, in the early 2000s, this, in the religious world, gave birth to what ultimately became the so-called emergent church stuff, which I think is sort of passé now. I think that whole thing has come and gone, and nobody's really into that anymore. At least not like they were in, say, between 2004 and like 2008 or 9, when all those books were being written about it. But anyway, to make a long story short, we're not going to get to correspondence view of the truth, so I'll have to pick it up there next time. Okay? So let me just recap. So what we've done is we've identified Pilate's question, what is truth? And we've looked at what are some ways people have tried to explain it. And so far what we've done is looked at three inadequate views, had a discussion about some related topics, not identical, but related topics, and then next week what we'll do is we'll start talking about this view here. Yeah?
You said the term the dialectic view of truth. What is that in a nutshell?
That's what Mike was talking about. That Hegelian dialectic, that you have a statement and then somebody comes up with an antithesis and then a thesis, and sort of it is sort of an evolving view of truth.
It's thrown pebbles into a pond of water, and the ripples
what the truth is. Yeah, kinda. And then you throw in another pebble, and that creates, and it's just constant pebble throwing. So. Appreciate your attention. You can shut it.